The Housing Finance and Policy Committee will come to order, and I will note this meeting is taking place under House Rule 10.01. Ms. Hirsch, please take the roll.
Chair Houseman?
Present.
Houseman, present. Vice Chair Howard?
Howard, present.
Howard, present. Representative Tice?
Tice, present.
Tice, present. Representative Agbaje?
Present.
Agbaje, present. Representative Bliss?
Present.
Bliss, present. Representative Gomez?
Gomez, present.
Gomez, present. Representative Hassan? Representative Hassan? Representative Heinrich?
Heinrich, present.
Heinrich, present. Representative Herr?
Present.
Herr, present. Representative Juergens?
Juergens, present.
Juergens, present. Representative Olson? Representative Olson? Representative Farr?
Olson did just appear. I don't know if you heard her speak.
I did not. Let me go back. Representative Olson?
Present.
Olson, present. Farr, present. Representative Ryer?
Representative Ryer, you are muted.
Ryer, present. And Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you. The next item of business is the approval of the minutes from Tuesday, February 8th. Representative Howard, would you like to move the approval of the minutes?
I will do so, Madam Chair.
And members, is there any discussion about the minutes? If not, you can unmute. And all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, I had the good fortune to be present at the birth of Homes for All. Back in the year 2012, the state wasn't doing very well in housing. And there were lots of groups working. They were all coming with different agendas. And there was a year we got nothing. And we sat in my office at the time and I said, we just can't ever let this happen again. We've got to get organized in the interim. And they did. The advocates actually organized. They get together in the interim. They debate ideas. They pass an agenda. And they come with a common voice. And I credit them with, in 2014, having turned around the investment that we were making in housing. And every year, they have continued to work hard. They represent thousands of people around the state. I consider them a treasured and valuable partner in our work, and just grateful for all they have done to get us to the point where we are today. Members, today's agenda is focused on the 2022 legislative platform of the Homes for All Coalition. We'll take questions for each testifier as they conclude their remarks, so please use the raise hand function, and we'll call on you when they have finished. We begin today with a presentation from the Minnesota Housing Partnership. There is a change to the agenda. We'll have Elizabeth Glidden present today instead of Libby Murphy. Ms. Glidden, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you so much. My name is Elizabeth Glidden. I'm the Deputy Executive Director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership, and I think I'm able to share my screen here. All right. So thank you so much. This is a presentation that will focus on some data and trends to give us a...
Does everyone else see the screen, or do we still have a technical issue? Mr. Wirth, I wonder if you can help us with... we don't have it on the screen yet.
You don't? Hang on just a second here. Thanks for letting me know, Chair. I think I haven't hit my final button. And I've lost my cursor here.
There it is. It's coming up now. There it is.
Thank you so much. I apologize. All right, so moving forward, just a little introduction of MHP. We are a 30-plus year nonprofit organization that works in three primary areas. We produce data-informed research, advocate for equitable housing policy, and provide community development services across the United States, specific to serving rural communities and Native nations. This is just a picture of where we work in Minnesota, some of the locations. Over the years, our community development work is largely funded through rural capacity building grants from the federal government. And we work directly with rural communities and tribal leaders to research, plan, and produce housing and community development projects. We also perform this work nationwide. This is sort of how we've expanded after our foundation in Minnesota. Again, as I said, this is a presentation that will focus on data and trends, and I want to acknowledge MHP's research manager, Gabriela Norton. We regularly produce legislative district and county profiles in a report called the State of the State's Housing, as well as other special reports. We'll just start with a few common definitions just to make sure we're on the same page here. Housing seems to use a lot of acronyms, so we find it's good just to do a little touch base reminder here. You'll see a lot of AMIs about area median income, and this is where we're looking at the median or middle household in a region. So that will depend on the region that you are looking at. And we are primarily looking at state of Minnesota for much of our data in this presentation. Also, just a note, we use that acronym NOAA. I know you're familiar, and this committee has discussed this quite a lot, the naturally occurring affordable housing. These are unique subset of the market rate products in the state of Minnesota and across the country. Much of MHP's work digs into understanding cost burden, understanding what happens when cost burden occurs, housing cost burden occurs. And this is a term that is defined as when you pay more than 30% of your rent for housing. Severe cost burden being when you pay more than 50% or more of your income on housing. And this is a term that is not income dependent. It could, you could have cost burden at any income level. However, as we'll see as we look in deeper into this data, those who are most impacted are those who have the least ability because they have the least income to withstand economic hardships. There's been a lot of data about what happens when you pay too much for housing. You are not then spending on other things that may be important to you, your medical care, your ability to support the education of your children, transportation, childcare. Also, it affects your ability to save and withstand those economic ups and downs or crises that may happen. And also, of course, you're also not then able to contribute generally to the economy of your community in the same way as you would. MHP also does a lot of examination of the intersection of work and the cost of housing. This is actually fresh data from DEED, looking at January of 22, what are those top five in-demand jobs for the state of Minnesota? And so it's a little bit different than what you might see in the 2021 State of the State's Housing. However, the bottom line is that as it has been for much time, that most of our in-demand jobs in the state of Minnesota do not, so to speak, pay the rent. Unless you are in that position of registered nurses, we are not seeing income match up to what is needed for a medium priced home or a two bedroom apartment. So starting to dig a little bit more into cost burden, we look at both homeowners as well as renters to identify what households across the state of Minnesota are experiencing cost burden. That number now for Minnesota is 25%. So one out of every four households in Minnesota experience cost burden, which is more than 550,000 5,000 households. Again, another layer of this data is now examining renter cost burden. So this is specific to renters. And this is one of the many heat maps that we do so that we are able to see where around the state renters are most experiencing this stress from housing cost burden. And again, showing that this is a statewide issue with different impacts all across our state. MHP has been looking more carefully at energy cost burden. I will note that utility costs are incorporated into the overall housing cost burden numbers that we have been showing to you. But looking at energy burden can be important for understanding certain slices of how people may be impacted by certain particular costs. This is particularly critical this year when we know that it is likely and households already are experiencing increases in utility costs, so greater energy cost burden than even what you would see in this slide. That energy burden is defined as when you pay more than 6% on energy bills from your income, with severe energy cost burden occurring when you pay more than 10% of your income on energy costs or utility costs. And looking at least a slice of that disaggregated data by income, we see that our lowest income households, ELI, extremely low income households, are paying in Minnesota 13% of their income, which is even higher than severe energy cost burden in this area. Some more disaggregated data by race and income. Here we are looking at cost burden and how that affects white renter households, Black renter households, and looking then at income, those renter households at 35,000 annual income with those households, 3 out of 4 experiencing cost burden. And then looking at severe cost burden renters. I will note here that, again, this is just a piece of this disaggregated income, but these are very significant differences between bright renter households and Black renter households, with Black renter households, 30% of those experiencing severe cost burden renters versus 22% of white renter households. And I think we should also match up these figures with ones we will see later about home ownership rates, and knowing that the majority of Black households are renter households, these severe cost burden numbers are even more significant and important to note. MHP has been working with the National Equity Atlas, which is hosted by PolicyLink, and they produce what they call a rent debt dashboard. So this is important new data that we have been following and working with PolicyLink on over the past year to try to understand the cost pressures and the economic crisis that is felt by many renters. This is data that is based on the December census pulse data, this particular data poll. And of course, what we see here is that there still remains tremendous total rent debt for Minnesotans statewide, with 65,000 households behind on rent. So we have been looking at this disaggregated data. It's important to continue to do this to really understand who benefits and who does not, and who is harmed and who is not by particular policies and practices and what we see in the marketplace. And so this is not a new slide, it's just an updated slide to what we have shown in previous presentations. We know that government and private actors have designed systems that discriminate against Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and Asian households. And without targeted remedies, we will not see correction of disparities by race. that are caused by the systems that we have created and are still in place today. We're going to take just a little bit of a look at what is happening in the marketplace in the marketplace and what's happening with investments. So this slide starts in the mid 2000s, in part because this is when we saw a very significant decrease during the Great Recession of housing production, and we have not recovered since. That green line is showing what we should see over time in terms of new housing production. We have much to do to be able to produce the housing needed by Minnesota families. At the same time, federal investments have continued to decline. Now, I have this slide, and yet we know that we have seen, you know, the most significant stimulus by the federal government in a very long time, maybe ever. However, I will just note again that that was a stimulus. It is a stimulus that was there to address severe economic harm, and it is not ongoing investments. So, and it has not corrected for failure to invest in prior decades and years. Rental assistance, just want to, this is a very important program. We have rental assistance programs in Minnesota, but our biggest rental assistance program is, of course, a federal program. And yet, this is a program that does not support those who are eligible. 3 out of 4 renter households that are eligible for rental assistance do not receive this. And yet, this kind of goes to what are the policy choices that have been made. All homeowners do receive a subsidy to support their housing needs. Little bit of this picture on housing production in Minnesota. This shows the mismatch between what is needed based on incomes versus what is today produced. And I do have this note to the side. This graph shows what has been the traditional production of about 100 units a year that serve households at 30% and under. In 2022, we had a very significant increase to that through the super RFP. And yet, even with that increase, it's still, even if that was the ongoing number, which I hope it is way below what needs to be produced to serve Minnesotans. Just another picture on what is needed here for those at that lowest income level. And the number that's important is the 114. Those are 114 households at 30% and under that do not have either affordable or available housing. We're almost to the end here. We included this slide here just to have a little bit more data for you on naturally occurring affordable homes. MHB has produced a series called Market Watch that has done examination over a number of years on this. We are looking here with this data at buildings that are fourplexes and greater, or four plus units and greater. And we are looking at buildings that hold their rents at 60% and below. But again, these are properties without subsidy or any affordability restrictions. So that can change at any time. This heat map shows statistically significant clustering of these naturally occurring affordable homes throughout the state in certain key locations. And again, this means that either these are properties that likely need significant capital investment. Often these are properties that are aging, and that may be one reason they are holding their rents low. Or they may be at risk for sale or increased rent, which can result in displacement of those renters who call those who call those properties home. So just in conclusion, this is another way that MHP has tried to put together what sometimes can seem like a very complicated picture of housing needs and types and solutions. And I guess we know that there is not one solution or magic bullet. However, we appreciate that you've taken some time to look at current data and trends that may impact the decisions you'll make as policymakers regarding homes and housing stability for Minnesota households. Thank you.
Thank you. And then if you could exit the PowerPoint so we get the gallery view back.
Am I out?
No.
I'm not. Okay, whoops, thank you.
There we go.
Thank you, Chair.
So any questions for Ms. Glidden? I think not. You were so thorough that we are good to go, I think. I don't, Mr. Wirth, you'll always correct me if I'm missing anyone, but I think. So we have the Wilder Foundation up next. We have two presenters from Wilder, Stephanie, and I should say for all the presenters, if I am mispronouncing your name, please correct me when you introduce yourself. Two presenters, Stephanie Nelson-Dusek and Michelle Gerard from the Wilder Foundation. Ms. Nelson-Dusek, are you going first?
No, actually Michelle is going to go first.
Okay, Ms. Gerard.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Housing Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Michelle Decker-Gerard. I'm a senior research manager at Wilder Research, which is an independent arm of the Wilder Foundation. And Stephanie is here with me today, and she'll be handling questions if there are any, but I'm going to be doing the majority of the presentation. So I'll share my screen. Always the most nerve-wracking part is the technology.
You are good to go.
Great, thank you. So today I'm here to talk about the Minnesota Homeless Study, which is a study Wilder Research has been involved with for the last 30 years, since way back in 1991, when we first started seeing a really growing population of people experiencing homelessness that became more visible on the streets of Minneapolis and St. Paul in particular. We do a study statewide, pretty much the same way, every 3 years since that time. And what we do is we organize around the state, every region of the state. So this map shows the continuum of care regions, which is the regions defined by HUD around the state to organize around housing. And in a one night period, we go to every emergency shelter, every domestic violence shelter, all the transitional housing programs. And then we work with outreach workers to interview people who are staying not in the shelter system in this 24-hour period. In addition, we do a companion study, a partnership study with American Indian tribes. There are Ojibwe tribes in Northern Minnesota that have participated since 2006. So it's a very widespread effort across the state to gather information. And this information that we collect is face-to-face interviews with people experiencing homelessness. They take about 45 minutes. We use a total of around 1,200 volunteers that help us with the study to do those interviews and go across the state in more than 400 sites. So it's a massive effort, a big organizing effort to really get a picture of the stories of people experiencing homelessness and to document those stories with data. And so this just shows a screenshot of our website, mnhomeless.org, where we have all sorts of information for every region of the state on the counts, but also the characteristics, most importantly, and trend lines of people experiencing homelessness in our state. So it fits really well with the information that Elizabeth just presented on housing and cost burden, because this is the population that's most impacted by that. They've lost their housing and have become homeless. So I'm going to present today the results of our 2018 study. Like I said, we do this study every 3 years. Last year in 2021, we had to postpone the study because of the pandemic. The burden on providers of just dealing with the emergency situation and the crisis at hand was enough. So we did not add the study burden on top of all that at that time, but we will be doing the study again within the next year. So what we saw was a leveling off of homelessness in the early 2000s, and then a sharp increase at the time of the Great Recession. And then the last time we did the study, we saw a 20% increase in people experiencing homelessness between 2015 and 2018. And that green dot that you'll see above our number, so the total count, 11,371, was the count of our Minnesota homeless population. And then we added the folks who were literally homeless on our American Indian reservations that participated in the study. And you can see by this slice that about 3,300 people in our homeless population are children. And so, you know, we see that there are more children that are homeless today than our entire population who were homeless when we first started doing the study, adults, children, everyone. And so that increase is an area of concern for us. We also use the survey data as well as other information, other data and studies out there, including the Minnesota Student Survey, to do an estimate of how many people experience homelessness in Minnesota over the course of any given night. So people that we missed as part of the study, you can't count everybody. And then over the course of the year. And we estimate that 19,600 Minnesotans experience homelessness on any given night, and over 50,000 people experience homelessness over the course of the year. Now, that might not mean that they stay in shelters during that time. They might stay in their car or other doubled up in a situation where they're sleeping in a warming house or some other situation, but that is including the entire people that we estimate experience homelessness. So we want to emphasize that our homeless population is extremely diverse. Everyone has their own story, their own individual story of what led to their homelessness. Our data groups people together to help help people understand the overall population, but everyone is an individual and has their own story. About half of our homeless population are young people, age 24 and younger. And so sometimes there's a misperception that our homeless population is single adults on their own, but we have a significant population of children and youth. And those are families with young children, as well as unaccompanied youth on their own without their parents. And then we also have a significant increase in our older adult population, our 55 plus population. That was in terms of age groups, that was our fastest growing population between 2015 and 2018. There was a 25% increase in the number of older adults experiencing homelessness. And this has to do with people, again, having a fixed income and then the growing rental costs and costs of housing and other basic necessities. So we're just gonna go quickly through, we have so much information that we could present to you, but today we're just gonna go through our key findings from the 2018 study. So sort of five key findings from the study. The first one is that there's not enough affordable housing. And this is something that Elizabeth just spoke about. So the median income of our homeless population, the homeless adults that we spoke to, was $550 a month. It varied. There's some people at zero all the way to higher incomes. But the median rent is over $900 at the time of doing this study. So you can see that there is a gap between what people make and what the rents are, thus leading to this issue with our housing, this population who are living really at the margins. We asked the people experiencing homelessness if they were on a waiting list for subsidized housing. So this is housing that supports, you know, sort of like Section 8 or other housing supports that pays for part of the rent. Half of our homeless adults were on a waiting list, and another 15% couldn't even get on the waiting list because it was closed. So again, people are trying to get on those waiting lists, trying to get the housings, but they're still on those waiting lists for housing. And we ask a number of different reasons of why people are homeless and why they can't access housing. And the number one reason of all those different reasons is there's no housing they can afford. Over half of our homeless adults said that that was contributing to their homelessness. Second primary point we want to make from our last study is that we really saw an increase in people staying outside of the shelter system. So in our study, what we normally see actually for the last two or three study periods that we've seen is our shelter population has remained very stable in terms of numbers. Basically, the shelters are full. And so you can't increase your shelter populations because there's no room to increase it. And so that population has remained stable over time. But what we saw last study was a 62% increase over 2015 in people who were staying outside of the shelter system. Now, if you recall, in 2018, there were a lot of encampments, as there have been recently. So there was the Wall of Forgotten Natives. There was the Cathedral Hill area encampments. There were encampments in Duluth and across our state. And we did do the study with as many encampments as we could, but we also did the study on transit. So there are a lot of people taking the train and using train for shelter as well. People that were staying in just hidden situations in their cars, et cetera. About a third of our homeless adult population had been turned away from shelter in the last 3 months due to a lack of space. So we also want to emphasize that some people are sheltered throughout their time. So they stay in an emergency shelter or a domestic violence shelter, but a lot of people move around. So in the night of the study, we might find them in shelter, but that doesn't mean that they were in shelter a week ago. They might have been outside or staying on a couch with a friend or family. We see a lot of people who are cobbling together different places to stay night after night. So of our whole homeless population, including people who are sheltered, about a quarter had spent at least a week outside in the past month. And that included 22% of our youth population had spent at least a week outside in the past month. And then in addition, some had spent nights doubled up or staying on people's couches, 17% of adults and 38% of youth. So particularly for our youth population, they're moving around from place to place, which is not a stable situation and makes people more vulnerable. The other story we want to talk about is that homeless people face obstacles to getting and keeping housing, and they're dealing with a lot of their own situations that need to be stabilized. It's hard to deal with different mental health and health conditions when you don't have stable housing. So about two-thirds of our homeless population has a serious mental health issues, a mental health problem that's they've been told by a doctor or nurse or a diagnosis. And over half have a chronic health condition. We're seeing a lot of people with diabetes and hooked up to oxygen. We have people with heart issues, et cetera, and they're dealing with those medications while in their homeless situation. For both mental health issues and chronic health issues, we've seen a steady increase in the percentage of our homeless adults who have those issues over the last, since we started doing the study. That trend line has gone up. And then in addition, about a quarter of our homeless adults also have substance abuse disorder, either alcohol or chemical abuse problems. That trend line has remained stable over time. It's been in those low 20% over the course of time of doing this study. But one of the big issues is the overlap of all these conditions that can really hinder people's ability to get housing and keep housing, but also just makes them extremely vulnerable while they're in their situation of homelessness. It's hard to get help. It's hard to take your meds. It's hard to get treatment when you're don't have stable housing. Another barrier that people face to getting or keeping housing is a history of being in jail or prison, so a criminal background history. So 1 in 3 homeless adult women and 2 in 3 homeless adult men. A lot of these histories are long ago, not recent histories. There are folks that, you know, are recently incarcerated, but many of these situations are a lengthy period of time ago. but it is does keep people from getting rental housing. And I just want to point out, for rental housing, most rental organizations, most housing providers do criminal background checks. But if you're going to buy a house, nobody is doing a criminal background check. So that is one of the disparities that we just wanted to point out. In addition, another trend line that we have seen increasing steadily over time is the percentage of women experiencing homelessness who left their last housing because of abuse. So domestic violence is a big issue, especially for the women experiencing homelessness and why they had to leave their last housing. One of the things that we dug into in our last study is something called adverse childhood experiences. And you all may be familiar with that. That is a big study done by the CDC in partnership with Kaiser Permanente in California, where they looked at a bunch of different health problems that people are experiencing and then asked a whole huge group of population a bunch of questions about their childhood. And that they found certain things popped up that caused health problems later in life and other problems as well. And so these adverse childhood experiences have been found to be linked with problems later in life. And we have asked those of our people experiencing homelessness. And what we found was that nearly all homeless adults and youth have experienced at least one adverse childhood experience or some trauma in childhood. But what is really linked to serious outcomes is people who have had three or more. And over half of our homeless population and over 6 in 10 of our youth population have experienced three or more adverse childhood experiences. And so one of the pieces of analysis that we did is we looked at their age that they first became homeless, if they had this trauma in childhood versus if they did not have this trauma in childhood. And you'll see by this slide that if you are homeless and as a child, your parent served time in prison, the average age you were first homeless was 19. So 11 years younger than if you did not have a parent who served time in prison. So this just really highlights an intervention point that we could take as a state to help prevent this cycle of homelessness. If we support families who have a family member in prison, experience neglect, any of these traumatic experiences in childhood, it could improve the situation so that people in childhood later in life could be stably housed. The fifth thing I just wanted to highlight, which is something Elizabeth highlighted as well, is the disproportionality or the ripple effects from discriminatory practices. And we really want to link this back to generational issues of who can get homeownership and who can't. So we're talking about redlining, we're talking about racial covenants that were very prominent in the Twin Cities and Minnesota early in the 20th century, where there are certain neighborhoods that people of color could not buy housing in. There's welfare reform policies that particularly targeted people of color. And there was the GI Bill that made it easier for white GIs than people of color GIs to buy housing. So all of these ripple effects of a bunch of different policies, and those are just a few, have led in combination with other things to this disproportionality in particularly our African-American. So the orange line is our homeless population and the blue line is the whole state of Minnesota's population. So 5% of Minnesota's population is Black or African-American, but 37% of our homeless population is Black or African-American. 1% of our state's population is Native American, and 12% of our homeless population. So serious disparities in those areas. And just wanted to also show that there are some differences in how that breaks down in Metro and Greater Minnesota. And for all of our homeless data, we do break it down by parts of the state. So folks can understand what's happening in their region of the state. So in Greater Minnesota, we see a higher proportion of American Indian, Native Americans who are homeless. And the Metro, almost half are Black or African Americans. And another issue we see is an overrepresentation of LGBTQ folks experiencing homelessness. So 10% of our homeless adults identify as LGBTQ and 22% of homeless youth. One of the questions we ask on the survey is for youth in particular, we ask a bunch of different questions about what contributed to their homelessness. And for LGBTQ folks, about a quarter of them do identify issues with their identity as being a contributor to their homelessness situation. So that was just what I consider a quick overview of our homeless data. We have so much more available. Like I said, for every region of the state, we have focuses on Native American populations. We also do a special report on older adults, veterans, youth, as well as LGBTQ folks experiencing homelessness. And we do special requests when needed. One of the things we did was at the beginning of the pandemic, the state asked us to do a special analysis of people that would be at highest risk. So people who are older or had chronic health issues so that they could write that into their FEMA application and let the feds know sort of the situation with our homeless population in our state. And with that, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you. We'll go back to our gallery view if you exit your PowerPoint. Questions of the presenter. I see no questions. So again, you did a very thorough job of the statistics, and thank you both for being here today, should we have had any questions. Thanks. Thanks very much. We now have Mandy Pant, Project for Pride and Living, who is joining us. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mandy Pant from Project for Pride and Living. Good morning, Chair Houseman, members of the committee. As I said, my name is Mandy Pant. I'm a project manager with Project for Pride and Living, or PPL, and I also serve as PPL's policy committee chair. And as part of that role, I regularly attend Homes for All policy meetings. PPL is a nonprofit organization that builds hope, assets, and self-reliance through affordable housing and workforce training in Twin Cities. We own and manage close to 1,600 units of affordable housing in the core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as several western suburbs. Close to 3,500 folks live with PPL every night. And alongside our housing work, we also provide career readiness training, matching several thousand promising workers with living wage jobs every year. I have worked for PPL in their housing development team for over 8 years and managing affordable housing projects from concept to funding applications, financial closings, design, and construction management. While working in both single family and multifamily arenas, I realized how impactful state and local housing policies can be. This is why PPL and I have become more involved in policy development and advocacy for funding and policy change. Decisions made at the legislature directly influence what kind of housing gets built and how much of it gets built. Therefore, a two-way communication is essential in designing the policies that are needed to serve the most vulnerable in our state. Because of my background and direct experience working to develop and preserve affordable housing, I've been asked today to highlight the items in the Build and Preserve More section of the Homes for All agenda. First, Homes for All is once again seeking a significant bonding investment from the legislature. This request incorporates $500 million in housing infrastructure bonds to support the development and preservation of deeply affordable housing, and $100 million to support preservation and safety upgrades to publicly owned housing. Bonds for housing are the most important financial tool we have to work towards meeting Minnesota's affordable housing need. With the addition of new eligible projects in recent years, like homeownership development, it is also our most flexible source to meeting the wide variety of housing needs in the communities we all call home. Secondly, we are seeking another new eligible use this year to expand the HIBs to support deeply affordable units for Minnesota households that don't necessarily need supportive housing services. 50% AMI for area median income, and even more so, 30% AMI units are our state's greatest housing need. And by expanding this use, we allow for greater flexibility. This would help households find stable housing without going through a traumatic experience of homelessness and find opportunities to build economic stability when they don't have to pay more than they can afford on rent. Third, Homes for All is once again seeking investments to preserve the naturally occurring affordable housing, or NOA. As you all know, once we lose NOA properties, they are gone for good and cause significant displacement impacting entire communities. Fourth, we are seeking an additional $9 million for Local Housing Trust Fund state match. This tool is crucial to building up capacity in our communities to have the ability to more immediately respond to community housing needs. According to a survey conducted by our partner MHP, the current $1 million allocation will be oversubscribed once the program launches. For more than a decade, Minnesota has not been able to keep up with the demands for more housing to meet the needs of our population, and certainly not nearly enough to meet the needs of those struggling with housing costs and instability. Like many issues, working to solve Minnesota's affordable housing crisis is complex, but a safe, affordable, and accessible home is a necessary foundation if we want to have better education outcomes for our children, healthcare that has meaningful long-term benefits, and places for our growing workforce to live. We can make progress towards meeting Minnesota's affordable housing needs with larger and more predictable investments to help our neighbors and communities thrive. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions now or in the future.
Thank you, Ms. Pant. Members, you may recall when Commissioner Ho was before our committee, on the issue of all of that, those bonding dollars, that she said they say no to three of every four applications. So that certainly makes the case for a robust request this year. So thank you, Ms. Pant. I see no questions at this point.
Thank you, Chair.
We'll go on to Ben Heldick Anderson from the Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hello. Thank you, Chair Hausman and members of the committee. So my name is Ben Helvick Anderson, and I'm the Vice President of Policy and Organizing at Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative. Many of you are familiar with Beacon, but if you are not, we are a collaborative of congregations that creates homes, provides shelter for families, and organizes to change policy so that all people have a home. We're a proud and active member of Homes for All. So I'm here to discuss the four policy items on the Homes for All policy agenda addressing housing stability and anti-displacement. We heard very clearly from the beginning presentations that we are in a housing stability crisis because too many Minnesotan families are forced to pay too much for their housing. These families often have to juggle a rent payment, which is continually increasing much faster than their wages, with other expensive realities like medical costs, childcare, and education. This leaves these families one crisis away from losing their home. The most effective and fiscally responsible way to help these families is to provide ongoing stability through rental assistance. This is the first policy item supported by Homes for All, the Bring It Home Minnesota campaign. Bring It Home Minnesota creates a state rent voucher system that would provide relief and stability to all families who need it. Universal rent support would end the housing instability crisis that is present in every county in our state. Minnesota families are barely hanging on. We've heard from previous days here with Minnesota rent help and the huge need that tried to relieve, people got a lifeline. With Bring It Home Minnesota, we can provide a strong foundation. You will hear more about this important legislation next Tuesday in the upcoming hearing, and we're very excited to share with you why we need to ensure every Minnesotan gets the rent support they deserve. The second Homes for All policy I will speak to today is reforms to our eviction system. Evictions have a devastating impact on renters' short and long-term housing stability across the state. More than 13,000 residential evictions are filed in Minnesota in a normal year. We have a three-part reform to this process. The first part is requiring pre-filing notice 14 days before our formal eviction action to allow tenants reasonable time to fix the problem. The second part is expunging evictions for tenants that remedy the situation after the eviction is filed. The third part is more resources for eviction defense from the American Rescue Plan dollars to balance the playing field for tenants in court right now. Another critical policy for stability is ensuring the health and safety of each living situation. Cost-burdened renters often are forced to live in substandard housing because of their limited choices of what they can afford. In Minnesota, there are 359,000 renter-occupied units that have potential lead hazards. Lead exposure is dangerous for young children and can cause permanent brain damage. Homes for All fully supports the Lead Safe Homes Bill because it invests the resources needed to solve this. The last policy I will speak to is support for federal dollars from the American Rescue Plan to support housing assistance navigators. These four policies that I've listed, Bring It Home Minnesota, eviction reform, Lead Safe Homes, and support for housing assistance navigators will bring immediate and lasting stability to hundreds of thousands of Minnesota families. Please support these policies. Thank you so much, Chair and members of this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson, for the presentation. I see no questions. And so we'll go on with Rhonda Otteson from the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. And she is one of the co-chairs of Homes for All Coalition. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Houseman and members of the committee. My name is Rhonda Otteson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, and like you said, one of the Homes for All co-chairs. It's my pleasure to be here today to talk about some pieces of the Homes for All agenda. For my portion of the hearing, I'll be highlighting the areas of the Homes for All agenda that includes a need for investment in the acquisition, rehabilitation, and construction of our state's shelter system through shelter capital, and funding to support the emergency services program, which supports shelters staffing operations throughout the state. While these funding priorities are primarily resolved in the Human Services Committee, it is important to note that the first step towards stability for many individuals and families starts with emergency shelter and the services provided through the emergency services program. Minnesota currently does not invest the needed resources into the homeless response system to set our Minnesota neighbors up for success. Homes for All supports creating safe, culturally appropriate, and accessible shelter for everyone until they have a safe and dignified home. Investing into our homeless response system is a racial equity issue. As Wilder noted, and MHP as well, Black, Indigenous, and people of color experience homelessness at much higher rates than the white population. According to the most recent data from the Homelessness Management Information System, Black Minnesotans are about 5% of the general population, but represent 36% of people experiencing homelessness. And the Native or Indigenous population is about 1% of our state population, but represent 18% of people experiencing homelessness. The first area I'll highlight in the agenda is the need to invest in shelter capital. Every region of the state needs access to additional shelter beds, and this statewide funding source would expand opportunities for culturally appropriate, accessible shelter across the state. According to the Homelessness Management Information System, 80 of our 87 counties in Minnesota lack enough shelter beds to meet the need. Over the past 2 years, the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless has worked closely with community leaders and partners all across Minnesota to identify and address unsheltered homelessness. MCH staff have gathered detailed information about the projects, and we are constantly learning of new projects, searching for the necessary resources to bring children, families, adults, veterans, and seniors inside. Here's what we know. There are 51 projects across every region of the state ready to be funded with a funding gap of almost $100 million. These investments would create and preserve 2,013 shelter beds through construction, acquisition, or rehabilitation of existing spaces. 827 new beds would be created and 1,186 beds would be preserved. There are a wide range of shelter projects needed. Examples include culturally specific shelter, domestic violence shelters, youth shelters, and medical respite shelters. And again, every single region of the state in Minnesota has shelter projects that are needed and identified. An investment in shelter capital will create safe indoor spaces for individuals and families sleeping outside or staying in unsafe conditions. Next, funding for the emergency services program is essential to fund the current shelter system and the proposed expansion of shelters. We support the governor's proposed budget of $95 million for this program over the next three fiscal years and the base allocation of $30 million per year in subsequent budgets. Now, the emergency services program is really important. It provides the best, most flexible source of funding for local communities to tailor services to the needs of their local community. This funding supports street outreach, staffing at shelters, shelter operations, drop-in centers, motel vouchers, and the support services needed for individuals and families as they seek a permanent home. The need for additional funding far exceeds current funding levels. According to the latest round of RFPs for this funding, DHS received $78 million in requests for this program and had just $16.4 million in state and federal funding to grant. As a result, the state could only fund 21% of all requests for this funding. As we all continue to navigate the pandemic, funding to rehabilitate shelters and fund solutions through the emergency services program are really essential to protect the health and safety of people experiencing homelessness. These resources will help build a more resilient, responsive, and effective homeless response system in our state as we navigate the changing nature of the pandemic. Ultimately, these investments will have a significant impact on improving the health and safety of people experiencing homelessness. Thank you all for your time, and I'm available for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Otteson. I see no questions. We also have Zach Eichten here, also from the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hausman, and thank you, members of the committee, for having us here. My name is Zach Eichten, and I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, as well as one of the three policy co-chairs for the Homes for All Coalition, alongside my colleagues, Annie Shapiro and Michael Dahl. As a policy committee, we have heard feedback for several years from both advocates and lawmakers about the need to discuss accessibility in housing and ensuring that everyone has a place to call home here in Minnesota. Quite frankly, we're not currently living up to that standard we know we want to set for ourselves. Many of our Minnesota neighbors do not have equitable access or fair treatment in housing. So this policy area is going to look to change that with some key initiatives that we're supporting. Broadly speaking, one area of this work is to create accessibility in housing for people with disabilities and with those who have mental health struggles. The first thing that we want to talk about today in this policy area is the push to increase accessibility in new housing developments that are funded through state funding or primarily through housing infrastructure bonds. And the way that we want to do that is increase the number of accessible units that are created using this funding, both physically accessible units, including some additional requirements such as roll-in showers so that folks with mobility accessibility needs actually have access in those accessible units, as well as a new form of accessible unit called sensory accessible units, which really looks at how folks with maybe not physical but sensory needs are able to live in community in the ways that they want to. The next way that we are looking to increase the number of units available for people with disabilities is to look at our senior housing projects and see how we can be adaptable to include people with disabilities as an eligible population in these new developments. Next, we want to expand access for people with mental health needs in our community. We're looking to expand the Bridges Housing Voucher. Bridges can help to bridge the gap for folks with mental health needs before they can get onto another permanent program such as a housing choice voucher. We're also looking at investing in incentivizing landlords to participate in getting people who may not have the best rental history into the community as well. And the way we're looking at doing that is investing in a landlord risk mitigation fund, which will help to incentivize folks to rent to people who may not have the best rental history out there. Finally, we want to ensure that people can find housing regardless of their income source. And therefore, Homes for All is going to continue pushing for source of income protections here in Minnesota to make sure that regardless of your income source, you will be able to find safe, affordable, accessible housing. Over the course of this session, when we prioritize housing, we're going to be ensuring that people have equitable access to housing as well as are being treated fairly in their housing if we are able to fund these initiatives. Thank you for all of your support to all the members of the committee on these issues as we work towards creating housing and systems in housing that work for all of our Minnesotan neighbors. Thank you, and I'm available for any questions now or throughout the rest of the session, as it's going to be quite a lengthy one, and we're excited to get to work.
Thank you, Mr. Acton. I see no questions at this point. Our next presenter is Dave Anderson from the All Parks Alliance for Change. He is also a co-chair of the Homes for All Coalition. Mr. Anderson.
Thank
you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Houseman and committee members. My name is Dave Anderson. As was mentioned, I'm the Executive Director of All Parks Alliance for Change, or APAC, and also one of the newly elected co-chairs of the Homes for All Coalition. I want to share with you proposals on our 2022 agenda that advance home ownership and wealth building. Home ownership, as we all know, is a key to wealth building for many Minnesotans. But many face increased barriers to achieving that dream, communities of color in particular. We must do more to support home ownership opportunities for those that have faced current and historical patterns of discrimination. First of all, many Minnesotans continue to be excluded from the housing market, which has profound impacts on quality of life, health, and wealth creation. While Minnesota has the third highest home ownership rate in the country, we also sadly, have the fifth highest disparity in home ownership rates between white households and households of color or Latino ethnicity. The coalition supports increasing public funds and attention to the preparation of homeowners, including home buyer education, housing counseling, and financial counseling. In addition, we also support weatherization expansion. Weatherization helps low-income households have more energy-efficient homes and reduce their energy burden in the long term, as well as keeping them safely and stably housed ongoing. Weatherization expansion would fund additional activities called pre-weatherization services, such as asbestos abatement, lead remediation, window and roof replacement, et cetera, that prepare more houses for weatherization and ensure people live in safer and healthier homes. We also support several proposals related to manufactured housing. Manufactured homes provide both extremely affordable housing and access to home ownership. On the broad continuum of housing that we need, this housing serves those with extremely low incomes. The average price of a new manufactured home is $74,200 compared to $296,400 on average for a newly constructed single family home. If the home is located in a manufactured home park, the cost to rent a home site is typically less than half the cost to rent a two bedroom apartment, $417 per month versus $894 per month. In addition, current model manufactured homes are rated as having the same quality of construction and longevity as site-built homes. Unfortunately, and dealing with the first of the manufactured housing issues on the agenda, park residents own their homes, but not the land under those homes. The land can be sold for redevelopment, and when a park closes, most homes are lost, either because they're too old to move, or they won't be accepted by another community. The opportunity to purchase House File 112 is a very simple proposal. It gives resident homeowners notice of a planned sale and 60 days to submit an offer. It doesn't require the landowner to sell to the residents, but it does provide that opportunity. We want to thank Representative Connie Bernardi for authoring this proposal and the Housing Finance and Policy Committee for supporting it last session. Currently, the proposal is being led by Senator Karen Housley in the Senate. In addition, the Manufactured Home Community Redevelopment Program, which provides grants to either purchase parks or improve park infrastructure, was launched in 2020. And since then, each round of funding has been significantly oversubscribed. There's currently $3.75 million appropriated for the program, but in 2021, Minnesota Housing received $9.5 million in requests. We support a proposal to increase the base appropriation to $5 million. Kind of bringing it down to the scale of home ownership and the individual homes, any home needs periodic reinvestment to maintain its habitability and its value. Most manufactured homes are treated as a depreciating personal property, and as a result, don't develop equity that can be used for reinvestment. Manufactured homes are often not eligible for home improvement loan programs, particularly if they're located on leased land. We support establishing a $2 million pilot project to provide loans for manufactured home rehab projects. Finally, for some manufactured homes, replacement is a better option than rehab, especially homes built prior to creation of what's referred to as the HUD code, a federal housing code established in 1976 and periodically updated. In some of these homes, residents find themselves cost burdened based on just the utility costs. We support establishing a $5 million pilot program, providing up to $20,000 in down payment assistance to households purchasing a new manufactured home, which could assist as many as 250 households. Thank you very much for your time. If I can, I'll help with any questions that people may have about the Homes for All, home ownership and wealth building proposals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And I am seeing no hands raised here. And so we'll go on to our final presenter, Linda Soderstrom, who is also a co-chair of the Homes for All Coalition. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you so much, Chair Hausman and committee members. My name is Linda Soderstrom. I am the newly elected at-large co-chair of Homes for All. And I am here today to tell you that I am a voucher holder, a Section 8 voucher holder. Despite having that wonderful voucher, for which I'm very grateful and thankful, I have been displaced several times and suffered the discriminations that are being discussed here today. When this Homes for All agenda is passed into law, it will bring us into a time of change for homeowning, for the preservation of NOAA, for more fair tenant access and protection, to keep the homes we are already in, and to shelter those who need that until they can have their own homes. And we all know that nothing goes well without a home. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Ms. Soderstrom. We have heard stories of people waiting for those Section 8 vouchers for years. What experience did you have as you sought the Section 8 voucher? Was yours hopefully more speedy than that?
It was absolutely speedy. I was in a common bond building where I paid 30% of my income there, and I was in the city of Winona, which has about a 28,000 population, and it's an island city, so it's kind of a small place. And when the vouchers came up there, after about 12 months only, I was able to port it immediately to the Twin Cities and have been using it ever since, and that was in 2010.
That is good news indeed. We have heard some stories not quite so helpful, and so we're happy about that. So I'm looking, that concludes all of our presenters. We've had just wonderful presenters, and you've gotten some sense of the broad range of the Homes for All Coalition agenda this year. And you'll be hearing more about bits and pieces of that as we bring bills forward for parts of this. But it was just a great introduction to the package, to the whole agenda. I'm just looking carefully for any raised hands to make sure I don't miss anyone. Mr. Ward, am I missing anyone? I see Representative Howard.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank all the testifiers as well. And just the entire presentation really does ground us in the work this committee has ahead this session. And, you know, what I'm struck by is just both the immense challenges facing Minnesota on the housing front, but our immense opportunity with the size of the surplus we have and what a charge we have as a committee and as a legislature to make some really transformational changes this session. So I sort of feel like if not now, when it comes to the kinds of investments we need to make in housing. It was a crisis before the pandemic, and I hope that we all feel the charge to do some big things this year.
Good, thank you. Well, members, normally tomorrow would not be our regular meeting date, but in fact, our next meeting is tomorrow at 10:30. It is a joint meeting with the Early Childhood Committee, and we'll be taking a look at the impact of housing instability on the youngest child. And so it takes us in another direction from much of the conversation we've had on our first few meetings, but we're looking forward to that. There being no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.